You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
And by the way, I used to, you know, the Never Trumpers, remember, they're on a respirator right now. They're gasping. You know, they're gasping for air. And many of them have been great. They've come over and they've been great. But I used to, early on when we had the Never Trump, Never Trump, I will never vote for Trump. Some of those people are now saying, I'd only vote for Trump. I love this guy. It's crazy. But they didn't know me. They didn't know. But, I used to say, if for no other reason, like this character in Utah, right? Who the hell was he? I mean, what happened to him? Remember, he was going to win Utah. He was a conservative. He said, he is a conservative, and he's going to win Utah. I said, so what? He wins Utah. So what does it mean? So let's say that it mattered a lot, and I lost, so that means that Hillary would have gotten to appoint justices of the United States Supreme Court, right? I'm trying to figure out. And by the way, not only did he not win Utah, I won Utah in a massive landslide, even though the press was saying it was tied. He came in third place. Hillary beat him. So I don't know what happened to this guy. But I thought it was terrible because it was so destructive. And I used to say to people, if for no other reason, vote for me. If for no other reason, it's the United States Supreme Court. Right? And Justice Scalia, who was great, I heard about 2 weeks ago, I heard his wife, who is an unbelievable woman and respected. She had signs, Trump signs, on her front lawn in Washington or Virginia. But she had Trump signs, just like that one. Trump Pence. How good is Pence, by the way, right? Is he good?
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us on the show today is Dr. Hunter Baker, Dean of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, as well as a research fellow at the ERLC, the Social Justice Warrior Arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. I told Andrew Walker that one day on the show, and he said there are certainly people who think that. I'll give you a chance to tell me that's not true before we get into our topic today.
Yeah, it's not true. I certainly will say that there are sensitive minds, right? I mean, you know, people who are seeking to be fair, to be just, probably not many folks in the group who would sign on to social justice as the sort of left wing ideology that we think of it as. Yeah.
Well, and this is maybe a topic for another podcast. The ERLC is the public policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, and it has come under some weird attacks in the last 4 years for reasons not unrelated to our topic today. But again, that's maybe a subject.
That's right on. I mean, the Russell Moore was squarely anti-Trump, never Trump,
right.
And and so was Al Mohler. But Al Mohler, like a lot of people, traveled to the point where he was able to vote for Trump the second time, if not the first. And Russell Moore basically was forced into kind of a relative quietude about the whole thing because of great resistance. Right. So Russell Moore would be the kind of person that I am addressing in this apology piece.
Yeah, and that's a good jumping off point. So we're talking to you today because on January 15th, roughly 120 hours before the end of the Trump administration, you published an essay at Public Discourse, I'll let you give the summary of that before I begin the interrogation. Can you tell us what you say in that essay?
Yeah, well, so I am a political conservative, have been basically my entire life. have really been involved in the movement one way or the other, whether as sort of a young reader of the magazines and stuff, and then a person who worked in public policy, a person involved in higher education, sort of a conservative through and through. And when Trump arrived on the scene in 2016, we really viewed him as a farcical spectacle, There was no sense whatsoever that he would actually get the nomination, much less be elected.
Can I ask, and you don't have to answer, but in, say, late 2015, early 2016, who was your Republican candidate? Who were you behind?
Yeah, for me, it was Rubio. Yeah, I was a Rubio guy all the way. But I liked other people. I liked Bobby Jindal. I liked, I know that he ended badly in Louisiana, but a tremendously bright person. I liked a lot of people in that field.
It was a great slate, right?
It really was. The governor of Wisconsin, who I'm blanking on,
Scott Walker,
you know, yeah. So, I thought Trump had no chance. And after he insulted John McCain, I thought he had even less chance. And, as we all know, the many candidates were unable to meet the challenge of Donald Trump's massive celebrity and their own division of each other's support bases.
Yeah.
And so he was the nominee. And my perspective, and actually this was also the perspective of Marco Rubio, if I recall, was, okay, this is what you're left with. It's either this or Hillary Clinton. And understanding the binary nature of American politics, it's not only Donald Trump you're getting. It's going to be all the people who are appointed, all the people who are in the administration. It's going to be these judges he promised to appoint, you know, things like that. Right. And so my perspective was practical politics demands that you just support Donald Trump and you go with it. But there were a lot of people that I like and respect who said that's absolutely impossible to do. Russell Moore being one of them. Jonah Goldberg at National Review, David French at National Review, Bill Kristol, we could kind of go down the list. And from my perspective, understanding binary American politics, you know, this is not Europe, right? If this were Germany, there would be this nationalist party with Donald Trump at the top, and I would go over and vote for the Christian Democrats. Right. And then we would see what kind of coalition would emerge. But that is not the world we live in the United States. And so I voted for Trump and I felt pretty largely vindicated throughout his term. I mean, he continued to be a nightmare in a lot of ways, but I felt pretty good about the public policy. Definitely felt good about the judges. And so generally, a lot of the Never Trumpers continue to be, in my mind, shrill and histrionic. And as I describe in the piece, I thought of them as being ideologically and emotionally fragile, right? They were not realistic about politics. I would say that publicly I was tolerant and understanding, but privately my judgment of these folks was pretty harsh. And the reason I wrote the apology is that their continuing refrain was that Donald Trump did not have the character to be the president of the United States.
Something with which I don't know how any reasonable person could disagree.
Well, yeah. I mean, my point was never had anything to do with Donald Trump's character. My point was, well, you get Trump. These are the people who have their hands on the controls, and you will get a better result than if the other side were, right?
Right.
But so, yes, there is this kind of concern about his character, and I kind of poo-pooed that. But then after the election, almost every day after the election, I began to realize that these folks had been right and I had been wrong. Trump continued to promote this rigged election theory. And that is really problematic for a lot of reasons. I mean, let's not leave aside. I don't think the evidence is there to support it. The people who I know who are deep into elections tell me that they don't think that it happened. But But the other thing is that for him, it is not noble or good to discourage the American people from believing in the election, the elective process, right? I mean, he is encouraging people to think that it's all one big rigged game. And what's happening then is you're poisoning the well, not only for your own, for the election we just had, but you're poisoning it for all the elections down the line, right? You are, there are all kinds of sort of corrosive effects for our democracy. And so I started thinking, this is exactly the kind of thing that I think the Never Trumpers were trying to say about Donald Trump, that he would be a danger to do this kind of a thing. And I started to think, you know, they were right and I was wrong. And then, of course, it got worse with him, you know, having this kind of gangsterish call with the Georgia Secretary of State, trying to encourage him to find 11,000 votes or something like that, to and of course the this whole deal with having people march to Washington on the day when they're going to certify the election. And I think that this was really the thing that was the final straw for me, was that I had earlier in the year, I think this was pre-COVID, I read a massive biography of Mussolini. And Mussolini, I don't know if people know, but he took power because, you know, they were having kind of a crisis in the government in Rome. And Mussolini ordered his black shirts to march on Rome, 60,000 young men to march on Rome. So there's a parallel, right? This large physical presence, okay? And then Mussolini has King Victor Emmanuel declare him to be in charge. And that's, to me, that's exactly what he was trying to do with Mike Pence. He kept claiming that Mike Pence had this power to, you know, refuse to certify the election. And to me, it's just a big set piece. I don't know if Steve Bannon or somebody like that was kind of interested in the history or mirroring the history or whatever else. But I just thought it looks like the kind of thing that a fascist would do. And that's another thing, is that people would say Donald Trump's a fascist. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, you're such a drama queen. And then I saw this and I thought, maybe you're not a drama queen. To me, he was acting like a fascist.
I mean, that's assuming, I think, more careful thought going into something than Donald Trump gives everything. But
well, it doesn't have to be Donald Trump, right? It can be people around Donald Trump.
I have to be careful how I say this, because I don't want to imply that he has no responsibility for what happened on January 6th. But I don't think he gave his speech thinking that the people there were going to go and batter down the Capitol doors and stream through the building. Now, once it happened, I don't think he was unhappy.
Let me say this. I don't think that he was trying to rouse them at this kind of crash in the Capitol, but I do think... And I think I say this in the piece, I do think that he was trying to create a physically intimidating presence, you know, a show of force at the Capitol that would put pressure specifically on Mike Pence. I think that was really who he was trying to influence. He was trying to get Mike Pence to take this sort of dramatic act. That's what the whole thing was for. And fortunately, Mike Pence was well enough steeped in the American political tradition that he wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's in one sense, that's what every protest is trying to do, right? To show numbers in an effort to influence the process. But this is specifically to try to influence the process counter to the way the process is supposed to work.
I mean, to create essentially an illegal result.
Right.
I mean, again, so I talk about faith in the electoral process. The other thing is the peaceful transition of power. I mean, that's an American tradition, something we've always been able to rely upon. And Donald Trump has messed with that. He threatened that. And so that, you know, that was another thing that kind of made me say, my pragmatic politics failed me in this instance.
Yeah, and I'm I'm a little concerned, and of course COVID messes with all of this as well. So I'm also a little concerned about the reaction of shutting down DC. I think it is important to be able to protest at an inauguration, as people did in 2016 when Trump was inaugurated, as people did in 2008 when Obama was inaugurated. I think that is important, but it may be that Trump has ruined it for everyone, right? I mean, it may be that just won't be allowed in the future because of concerns over peacefulness.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is, what would be great would be if Joe Biden is able to deliver on his promise of unifying us. I don't know if he'll do that, but there needs to be some repair work done on the polis. I took students through Crisis of the House Divided by Harry Jaffa about that sort of that midsection of the 19th century. And it was this bad then. Right. So I'm hoping we can recover.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry. I interrupted your going over your essay.
Well, I mean, I think that pretty much concludes it. I just the point is to say I think it's important to say when you were wrong about something, because I can never trust somebody who won't admit that they were wrong, who won't say that they made a mistake. And I spent 4 years thinking that the Never Trumpers were unreasonable, overly emotive, not a good judge of the situation. And so I thought it was important to say, no, you guys were right. I was wrong.
Yeah. And let me pass on some questions and two disclaimers here that I should give. First, I've never specifically identified as a Never Trumper, despite being called that repeatedly. And I think I've said pretty consistently through the last two presidential elections that I will light my ballot on fire before I'll vote for either party's candidate. And I stand by that. I maybe would have voted for Biden if he'd picked a more moderate running mate, or if he'd moderated the DNC platform, but he didn't, so I didn't. I do like some of what the Trump administration has done. I did see a path to voting for him, maybe especially in 2016. I hadn't originally thought there would be one, but then there were moments when he kind of looked like he was falling into the traditional Republican line and then just never did.
Yeah.
That's one disclaimer is I'm a little uncomfortable with the Never Trump label personally, not least because so often it implies an active endorsement of the Democrats.
It doesn't mean that. I mean,
no, but it can.
Yeah. I mean, Bill Kristol has started to fall in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, and the Lincoln Project, right? I mean, I was on board with that at first, and then all of a sudden they're like, and that's why we have to elect Joe Biden and win the Senate. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Yeah. Like, it's one thing to say I don't like what Donald Trump has done to the Republican Party. It's another thing to say, therefore, I want this other side that I also oppose to win. So,
yeah.
Again, I'm a little hesitant with the label.
Now, Quill, before you start giving me the tough questions, I just want to tell you, I did get a nice note from Evan McMullen, of all people, who liked the piece very much.
There were a couple of thousand people who voted for him in Missouri. So, the other disclaimer there is I've asked some people who are more explicitly Never Trumpers than me for questions, and I'm going to kind of mix them in with mine, and I'm usually not going to tell you which are which. Let's say, by way of example here, that you and I live next door to each other, and one day I come home with a big dog and put him in my backyard, and you tell me, hey, that dog is mean and I need to do something about it. And you tell me that regularly, and eventually my dog bites your kid, and I say to you, hey, I really just thought you were a giant whiner. I'm sorry for thinking that about you. I apologize for my attitude. Have I really given you any kind of worthwhile apology there?
That's not really the point. The point,
and yet it's what you said.
No, look. The point is that I'm trying to deal with the rupture on the right. I mean, so that question, I did get a lot of responses, particularly from people on the left. And I even had people calling my phone at work and, you know, oh, my God, you have blood on your hands. The blood of hundreds of thousands of people who died from COVID, blah, blah, blah. My point is not to give the healing balm for the Trump presidency. I really don't apologize for having voted for Trump. I really don't. I mean, it's very simple. As I have said about 50,000 times, it's a binary choice in the United States of America, pretty much, right? I mean, Coyle, you have kind of outlined how how you basically just withdrew from that process, more or less. But from my experience, and I allude to this in the piece, for example, I was a conservative pro-life lobbyist in Georgia during a time when both houses were controlled by Democrats. Okay. It was extraordinarily obvious to me, the disdain and the disrespect that they had for me and for what I was trying to do, in Georgia. Okay. And then when both houses of the Georgia legislature changed, things were completely different, right? That's the binary, right? In one, you're completely blocked, you're stymied, you can get nowhere, and in fact, you're hated. In the other, you have room to move, and maybe you can actually achieve what you're trying to achieve, right? So from my perspective, it was entirely reasonable to make a choice with that sort of expectation. What I'm apologizing for is not, you know, the travesty of what Donald Trump has done. It's more that I misjudged these people that I know and love and respect. And essentially, I'm saying to them, you know what? You guys were right. I was wrong. That's all I can say about it, is that I'm trying to set the stage for sort of a bringing the team back together, essentially. I think a lot of people on the left translated that as I was apologizing to them. I'm not apologizing to them. I mean, to me, they're still a big part of the problem. And I'm sure they think the same about me, right?
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
I think they want me to to repent of all my conservative positions and stuff. I'm not doing that, right? This is really an intramural apology.
Right.
To co-laborers in a cause.
Right. This is an in-house discussion, right? This question of how conservatism moves forward, or how the Republican Party moves forward, which is not necessarily the same question.
That's right. And it's published at a conservative outlet. I mean, you know.
Yeah, if I didn't say, this is on the public discourse, and there will be a link in the show notes to the article. So, again, I think that it's – so most of the comments that I got were variations on what exactly are you apologizing for, if you're saying, hey, you guys were right.
Let me elaborate. Let me elaborate on something. And so, again, part of why I am apologizing to the Never Trumpers is because it's not only that they were right, but they were right – I think I say this in the piece. They were right in a very precise – kind of a way. They had a very sort of a targeted correctness about what they were saying about Donald Trump. And so I thought it was important to say, to acknowledge, right? I thought it was important to acknowledge, you not only were you right, you hit the bullseye, right? You were absolutely right. It's important to say that. That's what it's about.
Yeah. I guess the hesitation here, again, if I'm reading these comments right, the hesitation is you're saying, yeah, you Never Trumpers were right, but I wasn't wrong. You're kind of wanting to have both sides of it, which isn't generally how apologies work.
Well,
right?
It's this simple. Is it the fact that in the United States you have a binary choice, essentially, in politics? Okay,
Well, again, I'm going to deny that, because you can vote a spoiler party, and they do genuinely spoil things, right? You know, ask George H.W. Bush or voters in Palm Beach County in 2000. I mean, the third parties affect things.
They do, but it still creates a result. It still creates a binary result.
But it affects the nature of that binary result. If everyone who had voted third party, even in 2016, had voted for Hillary Clinton, well,
let me put it to you this way: the case for voting for Trump was looking reasonably good prior to the aftermath of the election. Right? You got your as I pointed out in the piece.
Right.
There are a lot of things that I thought were positive that needed to happen. You got a change in the corporate tax rate, which is not talked about much, was very successful. It repatriated over $1 trillion to the United States. You had engagement with China, which I think was productive on trade, although they're going – well, let's say would have been productive by and large. And I think that's because it was understood that this is a long-term kind of engagement with China. It's important. So there's that. There's also the, I think, really important rollback of administrative regulations. You know, the idea that for every new one, you were going to repeal two old ones, that kind of stuff. Of course, the one that we were all focused on prior to the election, this was really the whole ballgame, was the judges, right? And you get your three solid judges, and and of course, people saw how Kavanaugh was treated in his confirmation. A lot of people took that. I remember a lot of people told me at that time that now they were going to vote for Trump when they had not before because of the way Kavanaugh was treated. So up to the end of his term, it's almost like we have comic book history where there's alternate worlds, Earth 1 and Earth 2. On Earth 2, right. Trump did not become a horse's rear end after the election.
Well, he didn't become one. I mean,
well, pardon me. Fully give full vent to, you know, completely enact whatever. But the point is that it could have been a reasonable perspective. I mean, there is an alternative set of events where this would have been that the gamble would have paid off. It would have been totally reasonable. Everything would have been okay, but it didn't. So all I'm trying to say is I think that there was certainly a good case to be made for voting for Trump. Now, obviously, you and I feel differently about that because I did and you didn't. Okay. But I think a lot of people agreed. He got the second most votes in American history. But again, it turns out that the specific nature of the threat, right? It turns out that the never-Trumpers on the right correctly identified the specific nature of the threat, and we saw that happen, and I'm trying to acknowledge that. It's that simple.
Yeah, and like you said, there are a lot of moving pieces here, up to and including party apparatus, right? The Democrats shut down their Trump style candidate in two elections, right? When they knocked out Bernie Sanders, and the Republicans decided not to do that, decided just to roll with it.
Well, I don't know that the Republicans. I think the Republicans were caught by surprise in 2016. You know, I mean, you have to think about it. I was following that one super closely, and I remember I'm pretty sure Trump lost in. Did he lose in New Hampshire or Iowa right off the bat?
He lost in Iowa, right? Ted Cruz won Iowa.
And I remember, if you were in kind of conservative magazine world, it was kind of like, phew, that threat's over, right? You know, so, I mean, I think that even up to the convention, people had the fantasy that Trump would be rejected. And it just never happened. So the Republicans were just totally caught by the surprise. This time, the Democrats, they saw what was happening, and they're like, we'll be darned if that's going to happen, you know, and they prevented it.
Yeah. And for, you know, for better or worse, I guess they won. So that's certainly short term better, whether again, if that's what matters. Although I think the well, this is getting into the Democrats. I think that the Bernie movement isn't going to go away, even if it's no longer coalescing around him. And same thing in the Republican Party. Trump is going to be out 3 days from now, but his supporters aren't going to disappear, even if there are far fewer of them as they age. And
the problem is that he was a one of a kind candidate. I don't know that somebody else can do the Trump thing without being Trump.
You don't think Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz pulled it off?
I feel really bad about Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, so I said that Rubio was my number one guy in 2016. Cruz was probably 1A for me.
Really? And interesting.
Yeah, because he is such a dedicated constitutionalist. So to see him, and you have to remember, he was really furious with Trump in 2016. He at the convention, he did not tell people to vote for Trump, right?
Yeah,
he gave
I remember.
His convention speech, vote your conscience, you know. So I'm really sorry to see him kind of fall down this hole, and I hope that he is able to emerge from it. Trump is I guess what I think is that if Trump had finished well, he could have been a kingmaker. I mean, he would have been able to control things in the Republican Party for a while, and
he might still.
Well, the question is, how deep is the sort of the ignominy, you know? I think that he's looking bad. I was on a talk radio show here locally, West Tennessee, hosts a couple of good old boys, and these guys struck me as shocked and humiliated by what Trump had done. So I'm not sure he's going to carry on as well as people may think he will.
I'm actually somewhat encouraged to hear that. If my social media feed, people who liked Trump before still like Trump, people who didn't like Trump before still don't like him, and it just everyone's doubled down on that. There's not been much in the way of apologies or conversions or what have you. Even the people who say he lost the election and don't like what happened on January 6th, they're still kind of Gorsuch.
Yeah, well, and let me say this. I mean, see, let's deal with this critique of my apology, so to speak. From my perspective, I'm making a pretty material concession, right? So you've just pointed out that most people are just doubling down on where they were before, right?
Right.
I am saying that I was wrong. He didn't have the character to be the president. If he were to run again, I would not vote for him, even if he were the only Republican option. I mean, so this is a significant step in the other direction. To me, when people react the way you kind of describe some people reacting, it's kind of like you're stabbing the person. Person offers you the olive branch and you stab them with it.
sure.
I may not be coming to the point you want me to come to, but I am making a material concession in all this.
Right. Let's a couple more questions about the piece, and then we'll let you go because I know we both have a semester coming up. You say in the essay, they were right. They deserve an apology from me for not perceiving that their concerns were grounded in reality, not merely some idealistic moral fragility. Yeah. I've got to ask, what is moral fragility? Because that sounds like a dumb, made-up progressive term.
Just that, it sounds like white fragility, right?
Sounds like a lot of progressive terms is what it sounds like.
Well, what I was getting at is that to me, I saw them as having such high, refined, finely wrought sensibilities that they could not tolerate the crude figure of Donald Trump, right?
Sure.
So in my mind, it was just that they couldn't see past his boorish personality. And in my mind, that made them sort of mentally weak, because they couldn't understand. It's sort of like they don't understand the game that we're playing, right? Well, it turns out they understood it pretty well.
Right. Well, where should conservatives and the Republican Party go from here?
Well, I mean, they have to find somebody who is the absolute opposite of Donald Trump. I don't mean that ideologically. What I mean is they have to find that person who is a great leader, both in terms of their ability as a statesman and sort of their moral example. That's who we have to find. Maybe that's Rubio. Maybe that's Sass. I don't know. They may have to do that and just suffer a loss when there is a Trump third party, right? There's going to be kind of a washout period on this. And you need somebody who can take you through that in a high-minded kind of way.
Right. I am certainly not opposed to the scrubbing of the Republican Party, over the next two to four years. I missed a question from one of the Never Trumpers that I consulted. So sort of like Mitch McConnell. So if you were watching on January 6th before the insanity started, McConnell gave this great like 5-minute speech on concession and the Republic and so on. And the response is, certainly my response was, that's phenomenal. Where was that kind of language 3 years ago or 2 years ago or 1 year ago? Like, what good is this coming in at 0 hour? Where were you with this 3 years ago?
Donald Trump, because at that point, the threat had not borne fruit in the way that it did so dramatically after the election. What happened after the election? So everything before, you can have kind of these legitimate differences about things and how much they matter. I mean, how much it matters for him to refer to a set of countries in a crass way or the other thing is that there's a certain amount of hardening. People had a pretty strong feeling of kind of the boy who cried wolf over the Russia stuff and even over the impeachment stuff.
Sure.
So there's definitely kind of a resistance to all the pointing to how extreme he is in that light. But in the end, he began to threaten fundamental parts of the American political tradition. It's no longer a difference over an issue or a policy or just the way he's acting. He began to threaten the American political order itself.
But he did that in 2016. He questioned the integrity of the 2016 election after he won it.
That's different. I mean,
that doesn't count.
It's not the same. That was just like, to me, that was just like blustering. I mean, that was, to me, he was setting the stage. You know, now he may have, had he lost, he may have tried to pull this same kind of stuff that he was pulling after this election. But it was in this election where he actually tried to interfere, right? This is not just him kind of blah, blah, you know. This is actually him trying to interfere, trying to create illegal, extra-legal type actions by the vice president to give them a veneer of legitimacy. So to me, it was beyond rhetoric. He was actually trying to make it happen. To me, that's different.
So had he just been tweeting this stuff after the election in 2020, it would have been fine. Would have just been 2016 all over again. But because of the...
Just tweeting meaning kind of the election's rigged.
This is rigged. Kind of I really won. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Jerks are stealing from me, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So to me, I found that profoundly disheartening, but it was the call to the Georgia Secretary of State and the massing of people at the Capitol and the pressure on Mike Pence that was really the decisive part of it.
It's certainly an escalation of the rhetoric, right? And a use of the presidential access, if not necessarily presidential power. Although even that, I think you could argue.
Yeah. Now, from my perspective, he has completely ruined himself. I mean, we'll see. I cannot imagine how angry his wife and children must be right now, because from my perspective, he has flushed the family name and brand down the toilet. He will have some residual political influence, but my guess is that he's going to be kind of a quiet and broken man after this. We'll see.
I think I might disagree with that. Well, I think he, whether or not he, you know, is say the Republican candidate for president in 2024, right? Whether or not he is that, unless there's a thorough cleansing of the Republican Party, and I don't see that happening realistically, but unless there is one, he will have the influence to keep anyone from being the Republican nominee. I think he will have a kind of veto over people, even if he can't actively pick who it's going to be.
Yeah, so it depends on, out of his 75 million votes or 74.2 million votes, whatever, I guess the question is the group that's strongly backing him 10 million or is it 65 million, right? Or something in between. My impression is that it's the smaller number, but I may be wrong.
I mean, his it's whatever number. So his popularity rating has sort of famously been stable, right? It's been at 40% as long as he's been president. Yeah. So whoever those people are, that's who it is.
Because it's different now. It's not like when he's trying to build the wall or
it hasn't or, dipped, you know, since, I mean, January 6th. It hasn't dipped since
you're
then.
You're kidding me. It's not any lower.
No,
right now?
It's at 40%.
I got to tell you, I didn't even bother to look. I assumed it was cratering right
well,
now.
Let me do a quick Google search because that was as of January 10th, and you know it's seven days later. I should have looked that
check
up.
Check the real clear.
Let's see, 538 Trump approval ratings. Oh no, it's down. It's 38.8%.
Well, not much, right? Okay.
So it's down since January 6th. It's dropped 3 points.
Okay. So maybe I have joined the small community of people with porcelain fine sensibilities.
well, welcome aboard. anything else you want to add in here? Anything you want to say to the Never Trump folks, to the non-Never Trump folks, to the Democrats? I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are thinking, I like to think, are thinking deeply about what things should look like moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the reason that I felt the need to offer an apology, although, as you have pointed out, one that many people are dissatisfied with, is that I have become a big believer in the philosophy of trying to mend the bridges to reach across the aisle. I think that we all need to do a lot of that. I think that we all have developed this tendency to double down on everything.
Yeah.
And you know, there's not really a good path forward for us that way. And so I'm trying to, again, however imperfectly, I'm trying to model at least not just sort of doubling down. I'm always right about everything. And I think that we need to do that more.
Yeah. And I will say, I appreciate that you wrote this. And I think it is a good sort of first step, right? Because there does need to be a path to reconciliation within conservatism, within the Republican Party, to both to hold on to the good stuff from the last 4 years. I think Trump, and I'm saying this as someone who kind of is inclined to despise populism, like that is my natural bent. It's also important to remember kind of what he brought, and that doesn't have to be bad, right? That kind of mass appeal doesn't have to be a negative thing. There's maybe a way to have a responsible populism, just as one example of something that needs to be held on to. So when I say scrub the Republican Party, I don't mean we just pretend the last 4 years didn't exist, right? But rather find a way for everyone in the party to have a genuine party and some kind of unity, that's good for us and good for the nation. Obviously, if we were Democrats, we'd be saying something similar, right? How to bind up the Bernie Sanders mainstream Democrat divide, right? How to bring them together without just caving into one side or the other. That's maybe an episode for another day.
Yeah, I think that part of Trump, this sort of to me the big lesson on Trump is that he is a phenomenal politician in two ways. One, he generates incredible support, right, as evidenced by getting the second most votes in history, but also in generating tremendous opposition, as evidenced by having the most ever cast against him in the same election. There's no chance the Bernie Sanders people were going to stay home with Donald Trump on the ballot.
Although in 2016, he claimed that he could get them. And I think he probably got some of the Bernie Sanders people in 2016.
Maybe so. I mean, certainly there are certainly things that he did. I mean, and this is another thing. I know we're supposed to be closing out, but listen to somebody like Jerome Powell, Fed chairman, mm-hmm. pre-COVID, he would say, this economy is helping people at the bottom more than it usually does. People at the bottom are rising faster. To some degree, that's in consequence of Donald Trump's policies. So that's important to remember as well.
This is all pre-COVID. In 2016, Trump basically said, Sanders' economic policies are my economic policies. That's almost a direct quote. Now, he was referring specifically to things like TPP and some of the kind of protectionism.
Trade,
So
the American worker.
And if not for some of the refusal to repudiate white nationalism in a more explicit way, some of the immigration policies that I don't even want to say could have been handled better. Were handled abysmally, to the point where even Franklin Graham is saying, "Hold on a second, right?" So again, had some of that gone differently, and of course, had COVID gone differently, 2020 might have turned out very different.
Yeah.
But then it would be harder to have this conversation about, all right, what does it look like to bring everything kind of back together? There wouldn't be that same concern. It would just be, it's all Donald Trump from here on out.
Yeah. Yep.
Huh. Well, that wasn't exactly where I'd intended the conversation to go. Dr. Baker, any closing words for us?
I would just say that now is a good time to try to reach out to each other. I guess the big thing I would say is that Americans, I think, underestimate how good they have it. That maybe now is a time to think about that, to reflect on that, and that we've got a lot that's worth preserving together. So it would be useful. Indeed, there's a compelling case to try to figure out how to do that.
For all of the negatives of the last 3 months with regard to the election, I love that state officials told the president of the United States to pound sand. I think that is a phenomenal sign of health in a time when there aren't many.
I'm very proud of Georgia's Secretary of State, and I'm proud of Mike Pence for not caving into the pressure. I think that's great.
Thanks again for coming on the show. I appreciate it. Always a good conversation when you're on. And I look forward to some of the stuff you're working on coming out so we can have you back on and talk about that.
All right. Thank you, Coyle.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, and the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.